is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a good day, no matter how ugly things are in the world. Some days we just have to disconnect, go deep in the woods or on the ocean or in the desert, not give a damn about the world and just enjoy being alive. Talk to your God, talk to your ancestors, and find peace and find strength. Then after you regroup, you can pick up that sword again. I have a very special guest today, Frank De Silva, who is the author of many articles, books, essays, and even poetry, which have accrued over a lifetime of intense searching, challenging the great ideas of politics, philosophy, history, social science, and matters of race. His search for truth has known no limits and often has taken him into areas of life that few have traveled. Mr. De Silva has been a loyal supporter of the struggle for the future of the West, both in its body and most importantly, in its spirit. Race is not simply a physical quality or biological entity, but each race possesses a racial soul. We belong to a spiritual race. It's no coincidence that each one of you was born into the race that you were. And each spiritual race manifests a different psychological, cultural, and metaphysical essence that holds the answers to your past, your present, and your future. That is why each race must see their preservation as a moral cause, a spiritual quest, and a sacred truth to be respected. It is for this reason the subject of race will never cease to exist. Now, I want you to all open your mind during this two-hour discussion that has many twists and turns, because you'll hear a term that, although still relatively new, has been given a bad association in your mind by our detractors. That phrase is white nationalism. And nationalism, or ethnostate. But it's time to deprogram the associations that arise with these words. As Frank will tell you, each ethnic group must at all costs liberate themselves from globalism, which would deny all distinct life forms from existing on the planet, turning true diversity into that of the equality of the slave. So sit back and relax and let the spirit take you. Welcome, Frank. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Lana.
Well, I read your book, The Rise of the West, and it was incredible. I'm not just saying that, but it was one of the most moving, powerfully inspiring books I've ever read. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. And I hope the folk feel the same way.
Well, for me, it's been a spiritual experience waking up to folk consciousness. And I know it's been for you for many years now. So what first inspired you to write The Rise of the West along with your other titles?
The impetus for Rise of the West was a dream. And it pretty interesting diversion if you've got a few minutes. And that is 4 o'clock in the morning. I woke up and I had the entire work written in my mind. And I rolled out of bed. And I just wrote down as brief a summary as possible, went back to sleep, and when I woke up again, I just started the project. But essentially, everything in the work was in my dream.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, I was thinking a good place to begin would be to first discuss race culture, what it is, and its purpose, as it is the basis of government, which we'll discuss. Is that a good place to begin?
Yes, ma'am. Race culture is the organic definition of both the synthesis of spirit and body. A culture is only defined by the blood or members of that tribe that created it. So that organic momentum over generations, perhaps thousands or tens of thousands of generations, creates what we now consider culture. So by definition, race culture represents the organic extension of a folk or people. And that can be any people.
Isn't there also a metaphysical element to this?
Oh, indeed there is. In my opinion, blood is the spiritual quality of form and function. And whether or not we were gifted this by God or the gods is a matter of debate for another time. But the essential quality when two people merge together and create a spirit, whether we were here before like the Celts believed, not like the Indic reincarnation, but the Celtic determinism, is that we are both extension and memory of those who came before. And that is a spiritual quality. The race memory, in Rise of the West, I use the term race memory. That is by itself a metaphysical description. But when you are engaged in two or more people around a campfire or in a group discussion, you'll feel and sense a term that you may be familiar with called synchronicity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Synchronicity is fate, destiny, the gods, whatever it is that brings people together in those unique moments in their life cycle, and some of the most powerful and introspective and proactive positions are created at that point. The great writers, women and men, have had a muse of some type that is also a spiritual implication. When something greater than yourself impregnates the discussion with fruit that bears, you know, another living creation. And that can be put to paper, that can be a spokesman or a spokeswoman. And these kind of things are all part of the dynamic of race.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how each race manifests its soul, which is seen in that particular culture. And in our folk, we see something unique and multifaceted, which I think is incredibly diverse, don't you think?
Yeah, every race is special. And this is, we'll get into this more. You know, the dichotomy between, we look at ourselves as being unique. So I'll run with that word. And I've had discussions with peers from Europe and the United States, South America, South Africa. And the bottom line is the old nomenclature of we are the very best. We are, it sets us up for this supremacy thing, for the, you are a supremacist, right? Yeah. So I will go with the word unique. And by definition, you and I and those that we love and hold dear, we are unique to each other. And we provide a distinct element on this earth. So I'm willing to fight for that. And I love it. I love our children, our old people, and most of us who are in this, I don't know if we can call it a movement or what kind of euphemism you want to use, but the collective consciousness as a unique people is worthy of our efforts.
So what elements do you think are required for a people, a race culture, to survive and to grow?
Extension is probably the best word that I resonate with. When you say to extend yourself, you're familiar with the 14 words, right?
Yes.
Okay, that has been around for 30 years, and it's not used a whole lot. So let's just use it again. The 14 words is a very simple aphorism, which says we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That is very proactive. And the whole point of being in rhetorical circles like we are this morning is that we can encourage each other to think and to create, like red ice creations. These nomenclatures, these words, they should be proactive. So everything that we do, everything that we see should be a positive step forward. And if you don't mind, we talked, or you mentioned, you were reading Gwalami Faye's Why We Fight, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what page this is, but if you would allow me, this is a quote from Why We Fight, and I really, really resonate with this. Reflection must serve action and is not to be confused with metaphysical tautologies. And he was speaking speaking of the over-intellectual positions in the worship of Ebola and a lot of our intellectual leaders, both in Europe and the United States. But as you started this discussion with spirituality, reflection, by definition, is a spiritual quality that we all possess. Not all of us can actually harness this. And this is kind of an evolution that I've been going through the last several years has been to, when you slow down, and I'm very active. I have 7 fire signs. It's kind of hard for me to reflect sometimes. But if you think about it, Lana, if reflection doesn't have to be a masturbatory intellectualization.
Mm-hmm.
To be reflective must also serve the action. The action is the survival of our people, right?
Yeah. Well, now it seems that we have a culture that's developing beside our true one, that it's not based on nature. It's a duality, as you say. Can you talk about that?
Specifically, you want me to discuss duality proper or the interrelationship between our present day and our past?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, this will be interesting. If we go back in time, whether it's to our Nordic roots or our Celtic, Teutonic, whatever. And we are all one people, but the different locations manifest themselves differently. But the same similar elements exist, that we are a very primal racial element. We resonate with the earth. And I most definitely, and I've always been this way, with water, earth, air, and fire. And I heard one of the other guests, I think Henrik was interviewing the individual, and he utilized the word atavism in somewhat of a negative, but I disagree, at least by degree, that the closer we are to the natural elements, call it Mother Earth, call it magic, call it whatever you will, the racial soul, but the deeper we are imbued with that resonance, the more powerful our outlook to the future and to each other really is. And proof of that is when you go to a rock concert and you hear a real nice riff, your body's moving, you feel that power, but then you listen to a ballad, and if the words are cognizant with the way you feel as a mother or a woman or a father and a man, you have children there, when those feelings are imbued in the context of music and lyrics, that's when people are willing to extend themselves and be courageous and be willing to sacrifice not just the intellectual masturbatory relationship that the Western Europe and the United States find themselves in. We don't have a dearth of intellectuals. We never have, Lana. For the last 45 years, we've had some of the greatest intellectuals in the United States and for hundreds of years in Europe. And only those few moments have we actually stopped and reflected and said, you know, we got to do something about this. So I'm with Faye on that reflection has to be a proactive part of the equation. And so does the naturalistic elements of our spiritual life.
And it seems that we've kind of gone away from that in the West, and that's why we're on this other track. I mean, natural man doesn't seem to be found in the city, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the irony is that there's a lot of enclaves in California where I'm at, and I've been to almost every state in the union, and you'll find a disconnect in most of the metropolitan areas, and in Rise of the West, I call that the cosmopolis, that almost Babel instinct to be brought together in this grand diversity everybody likes to talk about. But directly and indirectly, there is a disconnect. You have the various elements in the coexisting mentality of today's world is problematic. And I've been going over that for many, many years, the last 3 or 4 years, really carefully. And while there's a certain element of coexistence that, you know, to be a realistic person, you have to acknowledge, we have to coexist at some level. But that doesn't mean that we have to take the inferior position or even the superior. But if somebody threatens you with their race culture and they want to overtake you or they want to supersede you either through assimilation or whatever, comes a point you have to stand up and say, you know what, no, I'm going to draw a line in the sand and I'm sorry, you just can't step over that. And that's where the American West finds itself. Europe still has a very healthy, egocentric self-awareness, but man, they're actually worse off than we are. Look at France, look at Hungary, look at Poland, even some of the Nordic countries are being inundated relative to their national population. And, you know, as well as anybody else, you know that this reaction can be problematic. And that's why people like yourself, hopefully this discussion and all of your interviewees are bringing a discussion to this that is moderate and focused at the same time. No more reactionaries. And that's one thing I want people to really reflect amongst themselves and within themselves, is that no more reactionary screamers and, you know, yelling in the theater and all this angst and all this energy. I think we're beyond that. And we have the historical impetus that's actually a qualified presence in our life, you included. You're just now reading a work that was developed 25, 30 years ago. And then before that, I was introduced, and many of us of that generation were introduced to people who had spent 40 or 50 years doing this. So by extension, we have a historical foundation. Now it is up to us to utilize our minds, our spirit, and our proactive nature in an intelligent and forthright fashion. And we can do this. I tried to do this in the 80s by developing this, what I used to call the corporate mentality. And that was, we need our own buildings, Lana. We need our own source of income from the folk as an exchange process. And I talked about this with another interview I did a couple of years ago. And I will reiterate this. We need to become a professional body like everybody else.
Yeah.
Now, I realize that, you know, we're under the gun, and we don't have an NAACP, you know, and we don't have an ADL, we don't have an IBRIT and all that, but we can start it. We have the infrastructure here, and, you know, it just takes a couple of signatures, start a corporation, and do it. And we are doing it. There's so many young people that are really on board with this. I'm very proud of all these efforts.
Well, you see a lot of white student councils popping up, and we never saw those before, so that's a good sign.
Yes, it is. And that particular generation, really fascinating. The young people that I meet between 18 and 25 just blows my mind, because they are so way ahead of the game. These kids are learning about genetics with Dr. Watson, of course. He's paid a serious price for this beautiful scientific research, and he's selling his Nobel Peace Prize. He doesn't have.
Yeah, it's amazing.
To survive, it's amazing. It's a travesty. But these kids, men and women alike, are really embracing evolutionary psychology, genetics. They're asking questions about eugenics once again. What does it mean to become noble through the act of procreation? You know, these are questions that we haven't asked for almost 100 years. So, and they don't know anything about white nationalism or pro-European ethnocentric politics at all. They're just in, you know, today's educational system, but they're questioning these things. So as far as I'm concerned, we're already way, way on the right track.
I'd agree. Well, every man, every culture has a need for territory, boundaries, and it's perfectly natural. It's always existed. But for some reason, this modern thinking has led us to believe that this kind of nationalism is going to create some sort of mistrust in global conflict. But does it?
No. That's a very, very well said position. And the bottom line is, recently I was having a discussion about the word nationalism, and that that has a certain element of fire. You know, it resonates both a negative and a positive. But for this discussion, and I know we're preaching to the choir, but for those people who are coming on board for the first time, perhaps, to have a nation simply means that you have a folk, that you have a people, and boundaries come and go, but your blood remains. And nation, when people talk with pride about the American nation, as you and I both know, this country, whether people like it or not, was a European experiment. It doesn't matter how many non-whites were or were not on the continent, you know, when we ultimately developed the Constitution or the Articles of Confederation. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that the ethos of a European people, that spiritual quality of conceptualizing a nation, being located in the same nation with the same waterways, the same mountains, the same sky, the same ocean. These things are metaphysical by implication. And in a practical standpoint, they're the only things that qualify what could be termed a manifest destiny, or that genetic impulse to move and explore, to create where you're at. I mean, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, right? And she is a very, very sibylline creature, and she doesn't care who resides with her. She will destroy you if you just sit on your laurels. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you want to settle yourself, if you want to build a home, if you want to live in conjunction, not in conflict with nature, but in conjunction with her. Frank Lloyd Wright was a perfect example of a individual who would build with stone and wood with the lay of the land. So our conceptualization, I know we're always criticized as being all these lineal thinkers and we destroy the planet. Well, you know, that's as much garbage as it took the air for these people to talk about that. We have synchronistically lived with nature most of all the epochs that we have been on this planet. And yes, we've made some mistakes, but with time, with a proper government, with a proper national racial outlook, we can straighten this out.
I agree. Well, you just brought up the American Constitution, and I wanted to get your take on that. Was it right for our people?
What, the Constitution?
Yeah.
Was Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That was written for and by our people. It was written for ourselves and our posterity, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so that document, when I talk to black nationalists or, various non-white nationalistic or ethno-based groups, for the most part, they have no problem with that document being written by and for white Europeans. The problem comes when they, up to a point, are reasonably acquainted with the history and the documentation and the spirituality, if you will. But when they look at themselves in their enclaves, like in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, whatever, their tribal mechanisms are different than ours. And so by definition, they run into a conflict between a natural predisposition to think and act in a certain way while juxtaposed against our more perhaps lineal and spiritual outlook. And so I fully support individuals of these race cultures that while they can give us respect, they really do require their own relative constitution, their own dynamic for their own government, for their own nation state, however you want to term that. But this natural balkanization that's occurred in the United States is very problematic. And so we might as well just figure a way out, Lana. I mean, we need to all sit down with these other people without fear or favor and treat them equally like, they're going to treat us equally and just sit down and say, look, here's the question. What are the answers? And that would be a true racial dialogue, unlike Holder and the rest of these guys who talk about a dialogue, but they just want a dialogue on their own terms, not on the terms of what's elementally the very best for their people and for our people.
Yeah, you've said the government is the outward manifestation of its race culture, and I'd agree. And, I used to think of myself as an anarchist, but now I see that it's too loosey-goosey. We need to have some organization to be able to combat the forces that we're up against. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that, Lana. And I've known a lot of anarchists, and bless their hearts, they're very emotional. But if you try to pin them down on a worldview, on an extended delineation of an ethos that would continue anarchism, it won't work because they have no development plan, no qualified infrastructure based on intelligence planning and whatnot. It's pretty much reactionary. And look, I understand why they're upset. And a lot of these men and women are very, very good people. But there comes a time when all that energy that you just like shoot out into the netherworld because you're so angry or you feel disenfranchised, you got to calm down. And like Faye said, you have to reflect. And after that reflection is done, then continue to go forward. And white nationalism is that opportunity to do that.
Well, I agree. And also when I think in terms of white nationalism, we do incorporate voluntary principles. You're voluntarily there because you love your folk and you actually want to contribute to something. So that is the ultimate voluntary society in my eyes.
Good point, Lana. Yes, very well said.
Well, before we discuss what government is best suited for our folk, what do you predict happening in America? What are the stages before it's going to break up? I know you outlined 14 points in which I agree with in The Rise of the West.
Right. Okay, so I'm doing this on the fly. I don't usually have a lot of notes. So in lieu, people are going to have to read the book, and I encourage them to, for the first time in 40 years, to really start showing a very positive sense of exchange. You know, a lot of authors, including myself, really do require the folk to show us that support, and part of that support is financial remuneration. And I remember back in the 80s, we went through this same thing, and, you know, it's okay to volunteer and give of yourself and all that, but if we're going to go forward, then we got to start paying for this ourselves.
Yep.
So with that said, the infrastructure of the United States is, as we all know, is a disparate membrane, if you will, of these various colonies, black, brown, yellow, red, white. And while it may or may not have been, I mean, look, I'm not going to argue the point there were not Negroes brought to, or Africans brought to the United States, or Chinese for labor. But so were the Irish, and so were French and the Swedes and all this. Okay, so the majority was us. But as soon as the cultural norming occurred, i.e. we started to develop townships and we built churches and we started to actually physically manifest the race culture, the other members of the disparate races, they were kind of organically placed in their own settlements, or they were servants, indentured servants, and then eventually slaves and whatnot. We have to get beyond all of this nomenclature about master and slave and all that. I didn't have any slaves, neither did you. So no. Bottom line is, I do see the fabric of the country disintegrating. It's been disintegrating before I was born and before you were born. And this angst that everybody is feeling in the country, this inability to communicate and to feel safe in one's own township because, oh my God, it might be all ethnocentric European. Nobody disqualifies the black enclaves in the large cities or the Asians or whatever. So with that being said, there is going to be this centrifugal force that's completely going to separate us. And that's either going to be very violent, or it's going to be done in an intellectual and reflective way. So I do see the disintegration of the nation having already occurred. And everybody's trying to band-aid everything, and we have certain religious techniques that want to qualify the world as, you know, one organism, you know, that love has to be shared, that's going to conquer all, and all that, right?
Yep.
Well, in our own folk community, I would absolutely concur with that. I mean, to have a sense of love and respect for your, quote, fellow man is the way we all want to live. You and I and everybody we love and hold dear, we don't want conflict. And I'll be the first to kind of like jump up and say, you cannot keep a person down, or you, if you're talking crap about somebody behind their back, don't gossip. Don't be prejudicial about this position until you've heard the whole thing out. These are elements of our people that we offer to each other when we founded the American experiment. Where it becomes problematic, and I'm kind of weaving this around, is that in our modern day, we are a very altruistic people, and we want to help. We want to encourage the safety and health of our old people and everybody here, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those people take advantage of that altruistic streak, you know, and they want more and they want more. And there's a lot of debate that, you know, we pretty much made these people the way they are by always giving them hand to mouth or whatever. Well, regardless, the future of our country is one, balkanization by fiat, or it's balkanization by other means. And that's the territorial imperative is also another part of this discussion, but I'm not going to let the territorial imperative is very problematic because there's a certain ethos that is required by a people to even begin to think about that kind of effort. But it is happening naturally. And the different races, which have accumulated significant political power, have done that on their own accord, Lana.
Yep.
you got to give these people credit, from the NAACP to the B'nai B'rith or whatever. And white people, white Europeans in America, are just a little bit too far removed from the actual day-to-day happenings of governmental techniques. We might go to the voting booth and vote, but you're not. I don't see a lot of our people out there trying to pass legislation or getting signatures or whatever. And there's no law that says we can't do that, Lana.
That's right.
So it's just a matter of people not putting themselves in that position. And it's a whole different mindset. You know, when you see, quote, the liberals doing this, I know when I was younger, I kind of rolled my eyes. You know, it was everything from weed to pets to whales to whatever. And I'm kind of going, oh, wow, you know, it's kind of crazy. But no, they were trying to become a part of the system in a good way. And now, granted, Lana, you know, maybe the cards are stacked against everybody. That remains to be seen. But they became a part of the process. And guess what? They are in control of multimillion-dollar corporations. They are doing some good. And they are promoting their own agenda. So white people of America, get off of your asses and start to think about how you can do this in your own neighborhood, in your own state, and then the whole country. And it will start to congeal.
Exactly. Pay attention to where you're donating your money, not to some bullshit charity, but actually do something with it that you can see going on. You know, we need to fund our own movements, our own revolutions.
Very good, Lana. Very, very good. And the most easiest way is to pay people when they come to talk to you. And I'm not talking about the common folk. I'm talking about the people who are putting these things together. I remember back in the 80s, I used to get into arguments with people. I said, look, you got to pay these guys like $50 or $100 to pay them for gas. And people were so stingy, Lana. It was just ridiculous. And I will be repeating this. This whole concept of exchange, it's like patting this person on the back and saying, good job. We appreciate your efforts. Now, granted, there's a lot of scammers out there, Lana. There's a lot of people who they have ulterior motives. Okay, so we watch out for them. We find those people and we kick them on down the stairs, right?
Yep.
But those people, men and women alike, who are true believers, give them that pat on the back. And if they make a little money, hey, That's what makes the world go round, and we can talk about spirit all day long, but in this modern world, you know, you have to have it. So anyway, enough said on that.
It's true. Money's not evil, folks. It's what you do with it that counts. So and I feel like there's some great researchers out there, and I want to support them. I want them to have some wealth and to enjoy life because they're doing such a good service. So I have no problem with that at all.
Yeah, thank you, because our musicians, our intellectuals, our artists, and we have, you know, Bolton wrote a book, Carrie Bolton wrote a book.
Psychotic Left?
No, Artists of the Right.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Okay, I mean, he's one of a few guys that has even brought this up. Most of the people, quote unquote, on the right have to live with terms like fascist and Nazi and all that, and that's a whole other discussion there, but they were beautiful poets and beautiful artists. But nobody gave a rat's ass about them, right? A lot of these people died in obscurity, alcoholics, suicides, and whatnot. And they did that because people were ashamed or they were afraid to associate with those people based on these wedge words like I just used. So I encourage everybody, no matter what level or what degree you are trying to support and help your people, the rest of the folk, their obligation is to not run from these labels and to embrace at some point everybody in a disparate sense and then bring them in a more focused way into the arms of white nationalism. And white nationalism is just a term that I just came up with spontaneously. And my book, Foundations of the 21st Century, which talks about that, is just a watermark, Lana. You know, you might, this afternoon, you might come up with an aphorism or an idea that supersedes this work, just like Evola and Spangler and Simpson. These guys, they all put their spirit onto paper or in their talks, and then they passed on. And like Robert J. Matthews said, we are all born to die and continue the flow. And I think that with time, both our euphemisms will adapt and modify and evolve. But essentially, white nationalism is, in my mind, the code, the nomenclature that needs to be significantly reproduced in the greater world. And with time, somebody's going to come up with something else. It will change, but the direction will be the same.
Well, it's funny because in Europe, let's say if you're Swedish and you're a Swedish nationalist, well, Swedes are white, so you're a white nationalist. Nothing to be afraid of there.
Okay, good point. Thank you very much for that.
Well, so where did this term white nationalism first come from?
It was actually in almost the exact same reference you just described. I was being interviewed by somebody in Southern California, local paper, and she asked me a question that it goes along something like this. She goes, "You don't appear to be like these other, what did she call it, like bomb-throwing radicals or whatever the nomenclature was back in the day." And I says, "Well, I'm a nationalist." And then, man, right behind that, I go, "And I'm a white nationalist." And she looked at me and she goes, "I've never heard that before." And I didn't say anything at the time. But, I mean, it just seemed like normal because some of the blacks that I had met, and when I was a kid, when the Black Panthers were doing their thing and the SDS and all that, the Black Panthers considered themselves, at some degree, black nationalists or black nationalists. They were speaking for their people. And, you know, it just resonated. Black, white, yellow, brown, doesn't matter. We all are members of our own nation. And I'm not afraid of the term nationalist. If people want to look up the definition of nationalist in any good dictionary, it's tribe or people related by blood. It's real simple.
That's right. We should be nationalists for all races. All races should be allowed to thrive as a nation in their own territories. After all, that's supporting true diversity, right?
Very, very well said. And I concur with that. In all of my works, that is one of the main themes. The only true equality comes from a sense of identity. Don't you agree?
Yes.
Okay, so if that occurs, by definition, while we have diversity, we all have our individual boundaries that are respected. And if a white man disrespects the boundary of another, he has to pay a price. But that also means that those who transgress or trespass against us have to pay a price as well. So we can do it the easy way or we can do it the hard way, but it's self-respect, it's national respect, and it's respect for others that is absolutely the essential element of white nationalism.
Yeah, and we have to remind people, this is about, it's because we love our folk. It's not about hating other people. It's because you have a physical and spiritual connection to your people. That's why naturally you see neighborhoods segregate, because people just prefer to be with their own, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know?
That's right. Okay, now let me throw this in. This is something I have been going through for the last several years. Call it part of my evolutionary pathway or whatever. How do we, you and I, how do we look at those people, white, black, brown, yellow, red, whatever, who actually are comfortable in a particular location and they like, well, like might not be the right word, but they are willing to voluntarily work with one another up to a certain point? Is that something that we should look at in a negative fashion? Or should we look at the, and I don't like the word integration, Lana, but the integration of a certain political Volksgeist, if you will, like the American experiment? We're never going to be a pure white nation. That's just not going to happen. So for all of the people, all the true believers out there who take issue with me, just reflect on this. We're never, ever going to get to a complete end. And frankly, Lana, I don't believe that that would be the most realistic outlook. We can be majority like we were prior to World War I in World War II, we were like 97% of the population. And with that ethos being in the majority view, we had the ability to allow these diverse peoples to come in and go through our educational system or provide a certain business impetus or whatever. But it was done with the express understanding that they were not going to be replacing us. You know what I mean? There was that that natural dichotomy between a true minority and the majority. And so I brought up the first analogy because the word coexist always comes up and all that. And I've been in communities, Lana, that have had, I got to be careful here because I've been in communities that have had very small, disparate minorities, and everybody seems to get along. But our folk have to be in the majority. The end game has to keep us in a position of strength and not one of shared equality, because we both know that when that happens, the other elements are going to either see that as an opportunity or as a predator or whatever, and we will be crushed at that point. They will take us over, and it's just a matter of natural law. That's it.
Yeah, we're too nice. We let ourselves get emotionally manipulated, and we feel sorry for people. I'm always surprised when I see these women, you know, adopting these babies from Africa and giving all their money to all these other countries. And I'm like, do you know how many hungry little kids there are in Europe or in America? And we should be locally thinking, what could we do, like you said earlier, locally in our community? Who are the hungry white people that need help? And we should be looking after our folk first and foremost.
Yeah, I agree 100%. But let's, for the sake of discussion, what is the psychological elements of our sisters that will do that? In your opinion, Lana, what is the psychological reasoning behind a woman of childbearing age doing that?
I think it's now socially acceptable. They've been programmed into it with this political correctness. So you're taking the higher road if you don't have your own, but you take the kids that are already there. So yeah, it's completely, women unfortunately fall to trends. They're easily manipulated. And especially if you just have a commercial with some, you know, crying babies in some other foreign country, it's really easy to manipulate and pull their heartstrings. And I think that that's what's been going on. But also, these types of women want to be rewarded by society. They want to feel better than you. And by adopting African or Asian babies, their pathological society now tells these women they're so evolved. And then, of course, women see celebrities adopting African babies, and they want one like the latest accessory.
Good, Lonica. As a woman, I respect that your opinion. That's a good insight. So how do we juxtapose this? And you're familiar with the phrases, you know, we need to think from the heart chakra or the crown chakra, because there's a lot of real valuable information in the metaphysics of personal energy. So when we take this heart chakra, if you will, and we naturally imbue that into our folk, into our people, our neighbors, then as it continues to spread out and our people feel this need to support and show compassion and sympathy for these other people, what, in your opinion, can we say to them that will take their eyes and look to the Appalachians, or look to South Texas, or Southern California, to what's happened to white people, white European ethnics in our own country? How can we marginalize the outward look to the world and focus it once again on the family, on their family?
Well, if I take this back far enough, I think the first point would be to try and integrate some sort of a racial consciousness. And for Americans, they don't remember that they're actually European. They're not American. So first and foremost, going way back to our ancient pre-Christian cultures and remembering what your folk are, what their traditions are, what they celebrated, what they ate, what they dressed, to get that back into their head. And then we have to integrate the spiritual side, like you've been talking about, the metaphysical component of race. So they know that it's not just about skin color. This is about a soul level thing. And this is about our children and passing on that soul and those genes that we've had for thousands of years. So we do have to make it more spiritual and more family oriented and more about the future of our children.
That was beautifully said. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, not everybody is imbued with the historical nuances of our blood and soil. So what I tried to do in Rise of the West was I tried to, in a very succinct fashion, take the reader back to I go back to about 4,500 BC. We could go back tens of thousands of years, but I went back, 7,000, 8,000 years ago. And Rise of the West tries to develop in the reader's mind a beginning, a synchronistic origin that covered all of Europe. And that was considered part of one large migratory family. And from that point, I start discussing things about the manifestation of a people, art, music, mathematics, Archimedes, some of the people, the great philosophers, Plato, Socrates, the great writers, the musicians, the mathematics behind music is a purely Western motif. It's very lineal, and you think about some of the great composers, the lyricism of their lyrics and words, all based on mathematics, Lana. It blows my mind how much beauty we actually have created through our natural inclinations. And you follow this life cycle, and I try to do the best that I can in Rise of the West, and the genetic influence, the predispositions that we share as a Western folk idea, and I know that there's arguments amongst a lot of the Western Europeans right now about Americanism and there's no West left in America. Well, I disagree with them wholeheartedly. The race soul, the race memory is still alive and well in yourself, in me, and most of the people that we meet. When you start talking to me, it'll wake them up. So Rise of the West takes you from an organic beginning, walks you all the way into a burgeoning political and spiritual idea, and then leaves you, in, I hope, with an uplifting sense of purpose that, it's not only are we in a struggle, but we're part of destiny. And when you consider yourself part of destiny, you can't stop that. It is what it is. And it will morph and it will change, but it will always go forward. And remember that old phrase, get into the flow, yep. Step into the flow? Well, some of the people that may kind of chuckle at that, it's happened in my life and some very close individuals that in those quiet moments, when you really feel yourself being propelled in ways that you cannot actually put a reason all the time for, you, the Christians call it, the Holy Spirit, or the pre-Christians, our spiritual folk ancestors, they realized that it was becoming one with the earth, with nature. It's a very powerful thing, Lana. It's the germ plasm that creates music and architecture and war, because you have to have balance. So,
yeah, as I look around at things, I just think, hey, we've been around for thousands of years. We were pagans for thousands of years with traditions and knowledge passed down, sacred knowledge. We had our own mystics and shamans. We don't need to look to the East. But I see now that we're on this divergent path. And why I say that is because I feel like as part of our race culture comes the notion of a high culture evolving into better men and women. And we've diverged from that path, but I see we need to get back on that path. And I see that a white folk state is part of that for our particular race culture to continue and evolve. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And if you don't mind, I want to just read a couple of sentences from Rise of the West, because before this interview, I was just kind of meditating and having a little discussion with somebody, and this kind of just popped up. To be noble, which is being greater than the whole, to shout to the world the rightness and character of a higher culture means of necessity that one must strive to be worthy of this refrain, not simply limited to an individual basis, but collectively as well. National health, like individual health, starts with a healthy body. The organism of the smallest and largest of the units presents, and all start with the basic idea of the family, and I go off on another tangent there, but ultimately, to really to be noble, Lana, to be, and the French had a expression called noblesse oblige, to be noble is to be greater than the whole, even amongst our own people. And so for those few who feel that draw, that nobility, these are the natural leaders. And we have thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
I meet people in passing every day, Lana, that have this innate nobility, this Patterson sense of themselves, of which some people, you know, our own people included, go, oh, that's an arrogant person. But really, they're kind of what's left of the germplasm in its pure state. You can't teach this, not even at a finishing school. It just resides within you. And as long as you are aware of that, you can shout to the world the rightness and character of you belonging to a higher culture. And the West is a higher culture.
Yeah, you're right. It makes me think of what you're saying is a natural aristocracy among men and women. There are some people that just have that class, that finesse. They're very regal. They're like princes and princesses, and I see them too, but they're rare. But these are the people that we should be lifting up to, because there's a lot of these talented kind of natural aristocratic people that are actually very talented and intelligent, and I'd like to see more of that lifted up in the folk state.
Well, that's up to us, okay? I mean, by making people aware of that, I know in this quote-unquote democratic equality, you're not supposed to feel these racial memories, this aristocratic sensibility. Well, this is exactly why we are different than the rest of the world. And so instead of running from that, instead of hiding your light, we really do have, once again, put this back in our educational systems, in these churches. I got to be careful here, because the modern spirituality of the modern church is just, it's just an aberrant anti-life kind of worldview. Mm-hmm. And it's their own fault that they're losing parishioners, and they got to go to all these foreign countries to create these Christians, if you will. And I'm not a Christian basher. What I'm saying is, like, the religion of the West, which I point out in Rise of the West, has been Catholicism historically. And when groups of people that I knew back in the 70s and 80s, when we truly sat down, it didn't matter whether you were a, quote, pagan, and I don't like that term, by the way, but that pre-Christian naturalist or whatever, we didn't have a problem talking to our own people about Christianity or the faith of our fathers or the faith of our ancestors, because the primary modus operandi was to work forward for the betterment of our people so that we could have the liberty to argue these points out without being enslaved by, you know, a corporate mentality, globalism, you know, whatever it is. And by God, that's what people need to fight for, and they can't get hung up on these little passionate, you know, bitch sessions.
Yep, I agree. I also see, too, there's that Christian versus, I know you don't like that term, they didn't call themselves pagans either, I have to think, right, of another term, but right, there's a lot of people that have that fight going on that are white nationalists, and really, at the end of the day, this is about our survival, so we should put aside those arguments and just focus on the real war that's at hand.
Yes, Lana, so let me interject here. If they call themselves white nationalists, then they need to read The Foundation of the 21st Century, and what real white nationalists were about in its inception was that there is no room for this bickering. This bickering is self-defeating at the very least, and at worst, it's self-destructive. And I hear, you know, Christians on one side, they are attacking pagans, but Christianity is supposed to have this compassion and sympathy for their fellow men. Okay, so start living that first and foremost. And the pagans that are all mad because they consider Christianity being a destructive force in the ethos of the West. Get a handle on that too. Sit down with your brothers and sisters and just come to an agreement on who you are, and the rest will work itself out, because we are in a struggle. So, you know, quit fighting amongst yourselves and sit down with one another. Go to picnics together. You know, share the moment with your children, and it will all work itself out.
Yeah, it's interesting, because as a race culture, we are the most diverse. We have the polar opposite ideas flying around, but we're of the same people. So it can be challenging at times.
Well, 35 years ago, Lana, we went through this, and I'm not trying to date myself, but it really is frustrating, has been for me. 30 plus years ago, that we had a lot of opportunities, and 40 and 50 years ago, we did too. But faith in something unseen, while is a valuable metaphysical exercise, I guess, and in fact, to a lot of people, is a very real thing. We live on this earth, and we have nuts and bolts things that we need to do. And one of those is quit thinking like we are a conquered people. Like in Foundations, I talk about, ultimately, we consider ourselves to be conquered. If we didn't, we would stand up without fear or favor every time we thought we were being violated, would we not?
Of course. And we're still the majority.
In what respect?
I mean, as people in America, we're still the racial majority, and we're not even saying anything now?
Well, okay. I don't want to play with all the numbers, because, man, you can pull these numbers out of a hat. But last I saw, we were at 49% of the population.
Oh, okay.
So we're less than 8% of the world population. That's a number you're probably familiar with. Mm-hmm. But if that's true, if we're 49%, if we're 52%, ultimately, if you break that down into white males and white females, because white females vote in a different voting block than white males, and that's got it. We have to start talking to our women.
Yeah, I know.
Start talking to our men again, so we kind of get on the same page. But ultimately, we do not, as a voting block, one man, one vote. That's all crap, Lana. This one man, one vote thing is just ridiculous. So we're outvoted already, simply because even amongst our own, we're split so dramatically between left and right, male and female. We are not a telling force. Okay, so democracy, while ethically being a sound form of tribalism, if you will, is not the best form of government. And we'll get into that later. And what form of government, you know, is the best? I don't know. You know, let's just throw a card out and pick one. But aristocratic nations, monarchies, religious secular heads of state like Egypt, Venice for 1,000 years, Egypt for 3,000 years. You look at democracy, and we have not been around very long. When Periclean democracy lasted less than 100 years, the gentleman who inspired what we now consider a democracy, democratic rule, it always ushers in the dictator, always. And no one, you can't show me any other historical nuance or historical fact of the matter, is that democracy always leads to mob rule, and mob rule always leads to the dictator.
Yep. It seems we're on that path, aren't we? The left is creating a monster on the right that they have no idea what they're creating.
Well, now that's a good point. Because every move has a counter move. Every cause has an effect. Now, here's where it gets dicey for you and I, Lana, for two ethnic Europeans talking about this. If we are not in control of this, i.e. if we do not have some sense of white nationalism, a political unit, call it what you will, then the dialogue is created by either well-meaning or actual opposition forces, and always be aware of counter-revolution. And we are most definitely in a revolution. We have been for five or six generations, big time. So the counter-revolution is a lot of us, you and I, and people who think like us. Well, if you consider the Bolshevik Revolution and the French Revolution, those true believers that started at the ground level Guess who was always waiting in the wings to get their grubby little hands on everything? And it's happened in almost every major Western sociological revolt, that you've got people who are watching us, the common people, reacting both spiritually and intellectually. And once we get to that apex of momentum, man, they always insert themselves and they take the thing over.
Yeah,
and so
I know.
Our people need to really be educated, and my works are just one man's effort, and we have literally thousands of writers. So people need to pick a mind or a group of minds in a literary form and become quite enamored with that, and then they need to turn to their peers, and they need to start listening to those people who have that natural ability to project these thoughts, these spiritual qualities that will coalesce into a viable political unit. And we are 30 years behind times, and we're 75 years behind times if you go back prior to World War II, you know, and all that. So now, guys, it's actually time to reflect on what we need and to actually do something about that. And I mean, that is to associate, to talk, to work, and the guys too. The guys need to start actually putting their own guys to work, starting businesses, looking out for themselves like the black community does. Like Farrakhan owns a lot of cattle ranches and all that, and they feed a lot of inner city blacks and blacks in Chicago, New York, and that kind of thing. So whites need to do the same damn thing.
Yeah, don't be trader capitalists and bring in cheap non-white labor, because that's going to help wreck things. We have to start exactly having businesses and infiltrating all areas, maybe even the opposition, find out what they're up to, what they're doing.
We were doing that 30 years ago, Lana, and so, yeah, it's a great point. You know, there's all kinds of role models to choose from. You know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, whether you like these guys or not, they have a great business modality, and they ran with something that benefited our people at large. It doesn't mean we have to like these guys, but there's you, and there's me, and there's our next door neighbor, and there's the woodworker that you know that makes great rocking chairs or whatever. Encourage that person, or the woman that has developed a great musical business, or a music writer, or a performer, or whatever. We can get the words out without being paranoid. I watch these young people. They're trying to get their musical venues, and yes, the system is stacked against them. But these kids go to these bars, and they get drunk, and they start smashing the windows out because they're angry and they're mad and they have all this angst. You know, we need to chill out on that. And people like you and your husband, you need to go to a nice dinner place somewhere, have a glass of wine, and talk to the people next to you. Engage in these natural conversations. Go for a dance, you know, do some tango, do some waltzing or whatever, and you will meet those people in passing. Go to the opera, go to the beach, go to the park. You know, live your life. Don't live in this freaking wrapped up paranoid world of, you know, us and them.
Yeah.
Yes, it is us and them. But live your life and live it fully, and don't be afraid.
I agree. And with that, you can have children. I hear a lot of people say, oh, I can't have kids. It's such a horrible world out there, or I can't afford it. I mean, damn it, if our pioneer ancestors did it, you can have a kid and raise them and do it right, you know?
Very good, Lana. That is exactly right.
Do you anticipate the other side possibly staging some false flags and using some of the terminology we do to turn off the other white people that may be on the fence about some of these issues?
Well, yeah, but you know, we've been through this for so long. Well, I'm speaking for myself, Lana. I mean, I can spot these things a mile away, and of course, provocateurs. This thing in Ferguson, just to kind of deviate real quick, the local constabulary sent agent provocateurs into those crowds, and I've watched like three or four videos, and these guys were throwing rocks at, you know, their own guys, and you know, spitting on people just to get the agitators that much more agitated. So look, every system uses this Hegelian dialectics, this thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Ortega de Gasset wrote the small book, Revolt of the Masses, which is a really great psychological primer for anybody who wants to understand, you know, mob psychology and group psychology. But to answer your question, yeah, of course these things are going to happen. But you know what? Don't let that frighten you. The Catholics have people that murder people all the time, right? Because they happen to be Catholics. You know, so as these things come up, we have to deal with them first and foremost on our own by being aware and circumventing, you know, these agent provocateurs or whatever. But they're actually not that prevalent, Lana. This is part of the subculture of the paranoia that's kept everybody at bay. You can be aware. The men and women who are security oriented, let them provide security details for speakers. And boy, this is a whole other angle, because I had security details back in the 80s, and friends of mine had their own, and I learned a lot, ex-military, ex-police, that kind of thing. And it's real simple to look after your own. So keeping these guys at bay is fairly easy. The guys that are real difficult to keep out are the local police force people, obviously the government. These guys are professionals, and they know how to do that. And the average white nationalist is just a common man or woman. So it's something to consider, Lana, but don't lose any sleep over it.
Okay. So if we switch to the foundations of the 21st century, if we conceptualize our folk state, what would you say is important to us?
I think there's seven chapters, all lengthy chapters in Foundations. And I don't know, people tend to say I can pontificate, but I just, when you talk about a thing, you have to talk about it, in my opinion, in an exhaustive fashion. So like my paragraphs are pretty long, and you need to have an attention span. So everybody just grab a cup of coffee if you read any of this material, and just give it some time, and give any good writer or any person who has something to say, give them your time, because reading is very important. It's like speaking, but when you read and you're textually based, it will resonate with your soul. So when we talk about the governmental techniques, what I tried to do in Foundations was pretty simple. Chapter 4 entitled The Voice of Our People, and in that chapter I start running down everything from, and I'll just kind of go over real quick, the white nationalist conception of function and form, labor, unemployment, the medical profession, our elderly, after work retirement, education, children, crime and punishment, police force, land management and agriculture. White nationalist education is actually pretty good about our children. White nationalist position on family. And these are all very succinct points. They can be extrapolated on for the next, you know, 15 or 20 years. But at some point, we have to, as a people, come to that reaffirmation of traditional values, Lana, that will focus our attention once again on the future. Economics is something that, while I'm not an economics expert, this particular chapter pretty much says we must take control of our currency once again, like the Constitution gave that responsibility to Congress. We cannot have these international banks. And if we have international banks, they must be controlled by the people at large. Like, I'm not averse, Lana, to internationalism. That's a misconception by many of our detractors. White nationalists are the greatest of internationalists, if you follow my drift. We deal with the French, the Germans, the Swedes, the Scandinavians. We can deal on a real practical trading level with our own people, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they have these G9 summits and all that, but all these guys do, they're just toadies for the big banks. If we were doing this, if we want to trade with the Romanians, let's say, they make great shoes. They have these neat little boxes, and the Swedes have great furniture and great technology and all that. Well, by God, we just go ahead and we exchange with our own people.
Yeah.
And in doing so, we create wealth, we create stability. This is real internationalism. So I'm not averse to internationalism at that level.
Well, it's interesting, all the points that you brought up, too. It's like, we know what the problems are, and we actually know how to solve them, but it's just not happening intentionally because our government is not for us. They're not our government anymore. They're not interested in solving the problems. So I like that you actually laid out a lot of the issues that we're facing right now, and like, here's a way we can handle this, and here's a way we can handle that. Like, honest to God solutions.
The whole purpose of writing this was that in my generation, we were just sick and tired of all this intellectual masturbation, right? It's good to discuss with one another, but it doesn't go anywhere.
Nope.
And so, you know, trying to be proactive back in the 70s and 80s wasn't problematic. The sky was the limit, and things started to actually progress quite rapidly. We had publishers back in those days that were doing a pretty good job. There was no internet, but we had these newspapers that were going across the country. But what they lacked, Lorna, and what I want to encourage people to consider, is this corporate mentality, this real business modality that will make us, by definition, equal players with the rest of the world.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
You know, if you're going to do this, Lorna, then you got to at least step to the same level as those people around you. This cannot continue to be a subcultural manifestation.
Right down to, you know, there's a lot of white nationalists and people that are aware of these topics that have websites, that do videos, that do programs, make slick productions. Henrik and I talk about that all the time. You know, it's like, I know Greg Johnson's talked about that too. It's like, make it nice or don't make it at all. You know, let's have some high quality here. Let's be eye-catching. Let's be trend-setting. That's really what we need.
And speaking of Mr. Johnson, I have not met him, but I do find his efforts to be quite professional, and the appearance is spectacular. He is the first guy, and so he needs to keep his hands over his head so he doesn't swell too much. But of all of the efforts that I've seen over the last 35 plus years, he's been the first one to raise money, and kudos to him. It's not hard. He just simply provided a professional medium, and he asked for help. And this is something that, I mean, it's just as easy as that. So Lorna and Henrik, you know, through your subscriptions, and I think I read the other day that you have a llama.
Lana's Llama, yeah, clothing line I'm starting. It's organic and natural fiber because all the clothing out there is so toxic, and it's all made in China, of course.
Well, you say of course, but the Romanians are good textile.
Well, I'm doing it here and also in Europe, so I'll be different that way.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Lorna, I mean, this is I like this interview because it's more or less like just two people discussing these affairs, and our European brethren are available. They want to trade with the United States, and we can actually do some tremendous things. And Mr. Johnson has done that by providing his books. I believe his publisher is Wehrmacht & Wehrmacht. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's Countercurrents Publishing. He's doing it all himself now.
Yeah, okay. So this effort is to be commended. And he doesn't have to be the only guy doing that. We can have thousands of people. One of the things back in the 80s was that the, quote, leaders and the intellectuals of the day, which I have serious issues with even to this day, because they were extremely myopic, greedy, snobbish, and they did not want the grass to grow around them. Well, I, as a young man, saw that as the only thing that we could do as a viable political process was to encourage as many blades of grass to grow. When we mow it, you know, the harvest comes, we will have that much more to offer the world, and not just one or two isolated, you know, minds, if you will. So Mr. Johnson and people like him, in my mind, are doing a superb job. They are offering something wholesome to the folk, and we just need more of it.
I agree. Well, you have a heading in your book called The Social Contract, and you talk about the social and national responsibility of folk nationalists. Can you discuss that section?
Yeah, the social contract, by definition, is that unspoken resonance and loyalty that we share to each other, held in common. You go to certain communities and certain small communities, let's say 20,000, 30,000 or smaller, that social contract is not only a part of our nature, but it's a working solution to age, youth, the needs of the poor, the spiritual needs. This social contract is that old ancient tribal mechanism that inherently says we belong to one another. And like family is the nascent stage of nationalism. Family begins the origin of the working relationship of nation and its people. So the relationship between the government must remain and will always be the organic interdiction between the lineal process of government and the actual realization of people living together. And National Socialism, in many respects, came very, very close. So let's do a little bit better, or maybe not better, but let's provide each other with that sensibility of social responsibility and nationalistic obligation or national obligation. These two fundamental elements are part of our social contract between each other. When we were formed as a republic in the United States, not as a democracy, but as a republic, and it had all the aristocratic leanings of the old world and all that, but inherent in that document in the Constitution, which was an amazing, amazing feat and definitely divinely inspired or spiritually manifested, was that we attempted to give each other a certain amount of individualism, because I have serious problems with how individualism has morphed into this dystopic kind of, we're separated from each other to such a great extent that we can't do anything. There's no collective consciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So our government must be faced with the dichotomy of that social responsibility and that national obligation. And I think most of us are on the same page. So when it comes right down to talking about the nuts and bolts, like Daniel Johnson wrote the Pace Amendment. Have you ever read that?
No.
Well, Google it. You can pick it up. Mr. Johnson runs the American Freedom Party now.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I know who that is.
Bill Johnson, William Johnson. So, his effort when he put the Pace Amendment together was a pretty decent attempt. So you do need to verse yourself with some of the positions and it made its rounds and all that. It's a legal, basically a quasi-legal document. So we have the minds that can start this attempt, and the social contract, as a matter of course, will be a part of that expression.
Yeah, it's basically the tenets of white folk nationalism, right? The tenets for the folk unity consciousness, good rules to live by that we can all agree upon, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I can't remember where I put it right offhand, but, I threw down 10 tenets of white nationalism. And then I've got the 25 points, which was kind of like an ad hoc kind of a thing. It can always be redone, but I don't remember where the 10 points were in here, but nevertheless, spirit, form, and function. Form and function is a very, very viable discussion when it comes to anything from architecture to our folk community to our government. One follows the other. If you have the proper form, function pretty much comes along with it in a very balanced and moderate view. And I'm talking about if we live together. Extricating ourselves from all this other stuff is problematic, but still we will be able to rule ourselves, or at least to govern ourselves, if left alone, Lana. We'll usher in a thousand years or more of just the most splendid and light-filled future if left to our own devices.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you mentioned traditionalism, actually more radical traditionalism, and people confuse that with what we know of conservatives today, right?
Yeah.
And which, and they're two total different things. When I think of traditionalism, I think of something that's more primordial, like the family unit, for instance. That's primordial. I mean, we wouldn't survive without something like that.
Yes, correct. And conservatives, I will say this, I am disgusted with conservatives. And they leave a very bad taste in my mouth. And so for you conservatives listening out there, you need to reflect on what it means to be a modern day conservative, a Republican, or whatever little wedge word you want to give yourself. And if you don't put your folk first and understand that family is an extension, race is an extension of your family, but that family unit, which all these conservatives claim to be a part of them, is part of your race soul.
Mm-hmm.
Once you wrap your head around that, that the eyes that you're looking into today or this evening are like you. And I'm excluding those that may be with partners of another race, and I'm not going to deprecate them. But that man and woman who look at each other's eyes, and you see those souls that belong to one another, that is the basis of conservatism, to conserve what is healthy and right and what you belong to. That is what true conservatism is. But white nationalism is the radical traditionalism, the reinsertion of that radical traditionalism, that we have to go that step forward. I'm not a conservative. I probably haven't been a conservative since I was 15 or 16 years old. And well, just because I was very much aware that conservatives, while conserving a thing is good, you're just being held in stasis.
Yeah.
You're not moving forward. It's okay to resonate and protect what our ancestors did for us, but you and I are living our own lives, right? So there's change by definition. But as long as it's held within the confines of healthy traditionalism, you're not going to go wrong.
I agree. Well said. Another aspect I want to ask you is, what about science and technology? How would you see that playing with our folk community?
Science and technology is amazing. There's no end to what the human mind can come up with. And whether you call that divinely inspired or not, I'm not going to debate it. But science and technology is the offspring of our folk. And you can argue this point left and right, and people will already, you know, because we have very brilliant Indics and Chinese and Japanese. I am not discounting that whatsoever. That is beautiful diversity. When it comes to technology and science deals in facts, and Western empirical science, being the way you and I were raised, and I believe the most definitive of all the sciences. And, you know, we experiment. We physically observe things, and from computers to rocket scientists to genetics and eugenics, all of these efforts will benefit the entirety of the human race, if you will. And white nationalists should not be afraid of technology or where we're going with scientific inquiry and all that. It's part and part of us. For instance, I have known people in the past that are involved in stem cell research or the study of eugenics and genetics. And they want to hold this, you know, to their bosom and not allow this to get out. Well, as long as we are in control, and I mean financially through our institutions, we are in control of these things like our universities and whatnot. We define the dialogue. But in terms of stem cell research, and I don't know how much you know about this, Lana, but America, and you know who I'm talking about, those elements in our country that would dispossess us of those scientific inquiries and give them to other nations is doing it for one reason only, and that is to keep us dumbed down. And the largest stem cell manufacturer or institution on the planet just got sold to the Chinese. And by allowing that to happen, yeah, we can deal with the Chinese. That's not a problem. But if it's a natural creation of our own folk, then we need to keep these institutions alive and well in our own Western nations. That includes Europe and the United States, just simply for the sake of scientific inquiry. And a white nationalist government would most definitely be funding these types of efforts.
Yeah, I love the idea of, I mean, we're explorers. We should be exploring space now and finding new resources on other planets. I mean, how exciting would that be?
How exciting indeed.
Well, you brought up eugenics, and, you know, I used to think, oh, eugenics is a bad thing, you know, and I noticed a lot of people in the conspiracy field use it. But how is improving our genes a bad thing? And people are confusing it with dysgenics or the dumbing down or this, you know, synthetic mutation that's occurring with humanity, you know. So what do you think about eugenics?
Oh, yeah, I'm a big proponent of eugenics. And after everybody calms down from all the screeching and the gnashing of teeth, and, you know, it's ironic, Lana, that both the left and the right are using it to, you know, commit racial suicide in the process. Like the left, they bring up Margaret Sanger, and they try to, like, promote Margaret Sanger now as some, like, evil racist eugenicist. Well, Margaret Sanger, S.J. Holmes, Samuel J. Holmes, Professor Mendel, you know, the list in foundations, I give a list of all these geneticists and all these Nobel winning scientists. It's just phenomenal. Understanding that ultimately when a man and woman marry, they are the most basic and elemental eugenic processes. When you marry a man, in your case, and you know something about the family, you like his looks, you're drawn to the looks, and a good eugenics match would be similar hair color, similar physiology. All of these elementals produce a superior and more healthy and more intelligent person. And I don't mean to say superior in terms of the other races, but it is what it is. If you have a superior genetic stock, you are healthier. You are more adaptable.
And people do this unconsciously. Women look for a mate where they can improve their offspring. They don't realize it, whether it's some kind of resource or some kind of talent he has, some kind of ability or a certain feature about him. I mean, who doesn't want to have smarter, more beautiful children?
Not only that, Lana, but there's a certain, and in the epic poetry that I have been fortunate enough to be able to write, the term magic is one of my terms for the metaphysics, for the metaphysical things we can't explain, right? So this natural chemistry, while it can be problematic, Lana, if you are in a culture that has your culture, our culture, our ethnic based culture, when those chemicals are released, you know, oxytocin and that magical element that is both chemical and spiritual, the odds are that mate is going to be very similar physiologically, intellectually, in most of the cases, Lana. You know, this thing about first love and you're drawn to these people in a magical way or whatever. This is your evolutionary psychology talking to you, and it's saying this person right here is who is going to give you the best chance for survival, the most beautiful children. This is all eugenics is. And marriage, the institution of marriage, by definition, is our institution of eugenics. You know, hopefully when people marry one another, Lana, they've actually considered the ramifications. Are there dysgenic elements in the family? Is that individual intelligent? Does he have the capacity or does she have the capacity to expand not only their mind, but their ability to create? To create, that can be wealth, that can be woodworking, architecture, science, whatever the adaptability presents itself as. There is nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, there's everything right with that. And I'm not talking about eugenics where we're splicing DNA cells together and we're, you know, putting human heads on cows and, you know, whatever the hell they're doing today. I'm talking about the naturalistic understanding of what it means to choose a mate. That's real eugenics.
I know you brought up Margaret Sanger, and some people freak out because, well, she was tied up with the Rockefeller Foundation, and we know there's all kinds of things going on there, but she talked about rounding up the undesirables. But, I mean, really, I mean, if people are handicapped, they're not able to have children, isn't it our duty to look after them or to prevent that, because it's not going to be good in the long run? I mean, they're not even going to be able to take care of those children, and then we all have to take care of them.
Yeah, I mean, look, this goes without saying, and this may be sensitive to some people, but common sense dictates. I am not against abortion. You got to be real, real careful about this. Abortion in many cases, Lana, for instance, until we get to a point where when the sperm and the ovum meet and we know, like, right from the gate that this child's going to have Down syndrome or whatever. In lieu of that, if you take on the responsibility of a dysgenic child, not only does it detract in a major way from your personal life, this is not about sympathy or compassion. This is about being utilitarian. The state ends up paying for all this, right? And this discussion could get pretty wild, but ultimately, I would prefer that we take an intellectual position in taking the life of an unborn child, hopefully, you know, in a humane way, if there's no way for us to fix this poor child's life. I mean, these are all very deep and emotional, moral issues. And I'm not the last word on this, but we need to come to grips with what we are producing, both in a healthy and a dysfunctional kind of way. We have to come to grips with this. We cannot afford to keep doing this from an economic standpoint and from an emotional and moral standpoint. So let's start choosing our future as best we can, and that starts with a choice of a mate.
And it's quality, not quantity. I mean, I used to laugh when people used to talk about overpopulation, but I'm very well traveled, and it's getting populated out there. Resources are going to get used up, so we need to be responsible about these things.
Thank you. And the white nationalists should be at the forefront of all of these debates. We need to be creating the dialogue, not reacting to it. So I appreciate your commentary on that. Because unlike America, Europe is pretty crowded, huh?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how they keep taking in these immigrants. I mean, what's going to happen? Are they going to chop down all the rest of the forest and stack them all up in there?
Ah. And can we live any closer in the large metropolitan areas? Can we?
No.
No, we can't. It's unhealthy. You know, Dr. McDonald has done some great studies on this evolutionary psychology. And what was the guy that wrote... that book about population, I can't remember, but everybody's got their take on what's going to happen when we are overpopulated. Well, we are overpopulated. That's why we're creating GMO food.
Yeah.
Like, create more instead of going back to the soil mentality and keep our soil healthy, get rid of all this fertilizer and frickin' Monsanto and all these guys. And yeah, I am a super environmentalist. And, you know, every chance I get, Lana, I'm on any of these TV productions or whatever source I get my hands on. I'm very pro food co-op, grow our own food, no fertilizer. This thing about organic food.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, white nationalists, go organic.
Yep.
And the more that we buy, the more local farmers are going to be produced. And if any government, present or in the future, starts to detract from our ownership of land for the express purpose of building large corporate farms, then you, my friends, brothers and sisters, are not living in a free country. And in Rise to the West and Foundations, Lana, Frank, and whoever, we require land in perpetuity. Within our family nexus, in our community nexus, forever, paying taxes on land is anti-life.
Yes.
And I don't care about the economics. The state will survive through a whole litany of resources and taxations if we allow that. But our land must not be taxed. And we must own the land in perpetuity. That will keep the family proper located and those children that do decide to leave, when they end up in another place, they can start another homestead. and so on and so forth. But the government has no business saying yay or nay about after 30 years, Lana's worked her heart out and has four or five beautiful children, and they have organic farming going on and all that, and for whatever, you have a life illness, and then they can take that land? No. That is a crime against nature and against our people, and so that is one of the main tenets of white nationalism, and that is a social policy. So those nationalists that have a hard time wrapping their heads around having the state take care of our old people, or are infirm, by the way, Lonnie, if we have children that are Down syndrome, I know a lot of beautiful Down syndrome kids, and they're beautiful, then we have to pay for that, Lana.
Yeah.
And we can raise money for that. It's not a problem. But when it ultimately comes down to our foundational premise of land ownership, no state has the right to take that from us.
Got that right. I appreciate it. I also appreciate that you bring up the health aspect, because unfortunately there's a lot of white nationalists are still really, they're idiots about the fluoride, the GMOs, the pesticides.
Yeah.
They need to wisen up, because that's doing more to kill white people than anything else. It's also killing the fertility rate. So.
Ah, thank you, Lana. Yeah. Exactly. And you're not over the top. You are just a woman who is resonating with this, with the natural elements of your blood. It's like common sense. What are these people, retarded?
Yeah.
And no, seriously. I mean, white nationalists and you conservatives that have all this money. What are you going to do about chemtrails?
Yep.
What are you going to do about Monsanto and these? And Monsanto is not the big Satan, but they are part of a larger problem. They need to get a handle on their own house, because these synthetic fertilizers are killing people, and they are creating disasters amongst our people and amongst the black community and the Asian community and the Mexican community. These people need to get their act together, and if they don't, they need to be forced to do it.
Well, otherwise, a lot of these people are going to die. It really is going to be survival of the fittest. And if you're dumb and you're eating that stuff and partaking in that, then you're going to be taken out. It's just the hard truth of it.
Well, Lana, there's a lot of people I know, and in some future interview, I will turn you on to a couple of people, but tremendous advances. And God, our people are so beautiful, Lana. This, we have scientists like walking around that are like geniuses, and they can't get funded to save their life. Honey,
horrible.
You know, it's like it's insane, and they have never gone to a university. Nothing. They are like walking Teslas, right? So if we can get over the hump that we can put our soils back to the way they used to be, we are actually going to become a healthier people and a healthier world, and genetically we will be able to soften the blows that nature brings to us. Our autoimmune systems will become so much stronger. I mean, I practice acupuncture, and I believe in holistic medicines, and I believe in a lot of what a lot of people would call, you know, foo-foo spirituality, like Reiki and laying hands on people. I've seen it work. You know, I've seen what that energy that we bring to bear metaphysically can do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a whole other discussion. But come on, white nationalists cannot be limited to a political modality. It involves everything, the creative nature of who we are musically, medicinally, you know, culturally, all these manifestations. White nationalists are people who live life. They are not wrapped up in the traditions of the past only. They are living it daily and going forward, and they're not afraid to listen to different music within reason or different cultures. I mean, when I say within reason, I'm not afraid to mix it up with other people.
Of course not. People think that if you're a white nationalist, you're like afraid of black and brown people. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, you know?
Yeah, that's retarded. So, you know, if I go to a Cinco de Mayo parade, which I don't, but I have been, I can appreciate their cultural heritage, okay? But I know that I'm going to go back to my own.
Yeah.
I mean, that I have my own traditions, and I'm not at that level. I can exchange, okay? So white nationalists and conservatives and people who are, on the one hand, they say we have to live together, but then they're all freaking out, you know, about us becoming assimilated with these other cultures. Well, if you don't like it, well, then stop the immigration and stop it now and bring our European folk back at a level that it was prior to 1924. Okay, once you start doing that, with time, we can start to offset some of this. But immigration is an issue that has to be addressed, and this government's not going to do it. They've never done it, not Republican or Democrat. So bottom line is white nationalists and all of those ethnic nationalists that I've sat down with personally at tables and discussed, we can take care of this.
Yep.
You know, in a unified fashion. But the present state of affairs, it will just simply deny white ethnics their place, period, the end. And what's the code word? Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white.
Yep.
That is the truth of the matter. I have seen this hundreds of times.
And it's getting worse. I don't know if you've paid attention to a lot of the articles, but man, the stuff is just blatant in the media now, just anti-white media and legislation. It's just outrageous. But it's good because the more they push, the harder and the faster, the more people will wake up to what's going on.
Yeah, well, you know, I try not to use the words worse, Lana, because it was worse in the 80s, in the 70s, in the 60s. It was always worse.
Mm.
So let's not use nomenclature like that anymore. Let's just talk about what we are going to do about it.
Exactly.
What groups, what businesses, what institutions we're going to create. Not about how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
And even the opposite. You know what, Lana? One of the dialogues that's been created over the years and in foundations I talk about this, I don't need to utilize in my writings or in my discussion any of my opposition. I don't need to include professors and literary people. You know how we're supposed to be like really balanced? No, I'm going to go from my own sources, and every once in a while I'm going to throw in one of the opposition because they might say something really beautiful, right? But I'm going to create the dialogue. You are going to create the dialogue. We don't need those people.
Nope.
We walk our own path. And if they eventually see the writing on the wall, then these brilliant people will come to our side and we will bring them in as the family that they are. And we will work all these things out and we will head into a very bright future. But loser and, you know, it's getting worse and all that. You know what? It's been like that in every generation. So just focus on all of the positive. We have work to do. We're not here because of a Judaic element. We're not here because of the commies. We are not here because of that. We are here because we gave up on ourselves. We no longer had the courage to hold our ground. Or to go forward if we don't hold our ground. It's our fault. It's nobody else's fault but us.
Yep. I know we're coming up to a couple hours here. So I just wanted to squeeze in a couple more questions. I wanted to get your take on your thoughts on how do we get there from here? And are we also going to be breaking off from other whites who don't possess this folk consciousness?
Ah, man, I don't look at it like that. When you presuppose a sundering, then it's going to happen. I embrace all of our people. But by definition, it's already occurred, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you and I were sitting at a dinner table with some conservatives, I mean, it's already here. We are already sundered. So white nationalism is trying to bring this folk consciousness together. The governmental techniques are going to work themselves out. I mean, we have a great experiment in the United States of America. We've been very blessed with great dialogue. We're not afraid to discuss your rights versus my rights. It's common rights, you know, and these elements we've already worked out. So let's reinsert this radical traditionalism that it's just reinserting what we've forgotten or what we didn't have the heart or the courage to stand for. And in the process, we're not going to go back in time, Lana. We're going to go forward because not everything that I was raised with do I agree with now. You know, after 30 or 40 years, not every tradition that was taught to me that has stood the test of time is what I'm saying. That we can't afford not to change some of these things because the generations, you know, your age group and younger than that, you know, we all have our worldview, but we have these commonalities here. Traditions are valuable, but let's make new traditions.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. Well, last question for you. What words of wisdom do you have for the younger generation of white kids? They're a little impatient right now, but they see the importance of folk culture, blood and soil. So what words of wisdom do you have for them?
Well, words of wisdom is pretty commonsensical, I think. I can put my books aside for the moment and just talk to them. And I appreciate that last question. Bottom line is that from youth to age, look after each other. The youngsters that are growing up in the cities who are listening to my voice and your voice, they may have forgotten what it's like to go observe an older person at the park or to help an older woman across the street. And this is not just like, you know, being weird if you're young. This is about you taking the time to take care of your people. That's number one. Number two, you youngsters that are into music, and you songwriters out there, you know, skinhead crews were good in their day, but music is evolving, and some of those young men are grown men now, and like Saga from Sweden, beautiful voices, great lyricists. Continue to pursue your musical careers. Write your lyrics. Remember what it was like to create beautiful music, orchestration, ballads, acoustic music. Bring that back. Bring that back to your folk again so you can play in the park. You know, the older people can sit down and listen to some of this music. And then, of course, you can kick ass and take names and compete, you know, in the rest of the world too, right? But go out and get your education. Pick your educational universities and schools as best you can. And if you can't afford it, we have some great public institutions left. Or if you were lucky enough to be taking homeschooling lessons by your mother, your parents, or what have you, run with that. Read as much as you can, and do not be afraid to talk to other people about what you see going on around you. Fear really is the mind killer, and fear promotes the paranoiac to the point of inaction. It's okay to be cautious. It's okay to be aware of actual threats to your community, to your person, to your nation, as best you can see it. But don't hide in a corner. Embrace your comrades, your brothers and sisters, and come up with solutions. Become a part of your local school boards. Go to your civic meetings. I'm really big on encouraging men and women and young people to go and sit at the local water board, you know, or listen to what's going on with the merchants in your township. Be aware. Don't be afraid to show yourself as a citizen and as an ethnic citizen. That's all I got to say on that.
Well, Frank, please give us your website and book information before we end it for now.
Well, I don't have a website, but people can peruse a blog, a couple of blogs that have been put up by friends of mine. You can go to Foundations 21st, that's 21st, century, at wordpress.com. And the other one is simply riseofthewest.wordpress.com. Those two. The guys that are putting that up are doing a pretty good job, and they're kind of hit and miss sometimes, but they do a decent job. But go and check out my works. You know, whatever the muse and, you know, the spiritual energy has allowed me to do, I do have a lot to say, and I've tried to craft this work as best I can. But go to Amazon.com, go to the author page, and see if there's anything in there that strikes your fancy. And I did write the first volume of the book discussing the Silent Brotherhood, and hopefully we might talk about that some other time.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's been a blast.
All right, you too, Lana. Bless you, and bless Henrik. Good talking with you.
Well, folks, I hope you've been inspired and encouraged, because it's important to have our own form of church, communion with our spiritual race family. Because this is a war we find ourselves in, a war which is both physical and spiritual, and we must groom ourselves for battle. We must become tactical. There is a dark force moving on the planet that requires a fight on multiple levels, and there is a power when we collectively fight on a spiritual realm simultaneously while also doing the physical footwork on the battlefield. So if you feel moved, what are your talents? What are your abilities? And how can you put them to use to be a contributing counterforce? I hope you all think about that and make some changes in your life to reposition yourself physically and spiritually. To me, there is no greater reward than self-respect, dignity. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. But before I go, I highly recommend Frank De Silva's books, namely The Rise of the West and Foundations of the 21st Century. Radio314.com is the website where you can find my social network and where you can sign up for a Red Ice membership to help support our work. Have a good night.